All right, so so this is our second keynote session. So basically, what we've had so far is a first keynote session to kick off the program, introduce you to some of the mysteries of theoretical physics in the 21st century. And then we had last week a whole bunch of lectures on special relativity and quantum, and now some lectures on general relativity. And so now that you guys are experts in 20th century theoretical physics, it's now time to bring on the mentoring, the keynote sessions in full swing. Okay, so so let's see. So the idea of these keynote sessions is as I said before, is to introduce you to some of the deepest questions that we're asking today. What are the unanswered questions? What are the mysteries? What's keeping these theoretical physicists awake these days? So I'm delighted that we have with us today Rob. You have a bio of Rob, a bio and an abstract. So I'll just hit a couple of highlights. So Rob studied physics and philosophy at McGill, and he did his MSc and PhD at the University of Toronto. He's now a faculty at the Premier Institute here, and his area of research is both foundations of quantum mechanics and quantum information theory. So he's thought a lot about questions in those areas. So if you have some questions that we haven't been able to answer for you during the last week or so, and they're pent up and you're ready to ask them, this is the guy to ask them. And hopefully we'll have a little bit of time towards the end of the talk. And during the talk, you can ask questions as well. So Rob is going to be talking about the strange quantum. What does it mean? And how can we use it? So let's give Rob a warm ISYP.
Okay, so in this talk, I'm going to be talking about both quantum foundations and quantum information theory, the two topics that Richard mentioned. And so there's really two parts. One is going to be, what can we do with quantum mechanics? What interesting new practical applications are there of quantum mechanics? That's the quantum information part of the talk. And the other is, what does it mean? So I'm going to say a little bit about the problems of interpreting the theory. And I find these two topics go well together. Once you know what you can do with something, it helps you try to understand what it's about. There's not going to be much mathematics in this talk. I'm going to give you mostly a presentation of what actually happens, a description of what goes on in the lab, and no description of the mathematical formalism which predicts what's going to happen in the lab. But that's useful because often we get blinded by the mathematical formalism and we forget to look at just what's going on, and trying to understand, you know, how could the world possibly be given what we see. If you have any questions, stop me at any point. It's much better to stop me if you're confused, and then we'll talk about it, rather than me going on and leaving behind. Okay, so I like to start these talks with a nice Gary Larson cartoon. So this is God creating the Earth, and he's adding all kinds of stuff, like insects and birds and whatnot. And then finally, he's adding jerks. The reason being that it'll make things interesting. And quantum mechanics is a bit like that for physicists. It's very counterintuitive. It makes life very hard. It makes life difficult because we don't really understand what it's trying to say about the world. But on the other hand, it makes life interesting. It's very mysterious. And personally, I was attracted to study quantum theory because it was so mysterious, and because it resisted attempts to try to understand. So I'm going to try to tell you today a bit about that mystery. Okay, so you heard a bit about the history. I'll say just a couple words about it. Quantum theory was developed early in the 20th century. The first ideas were by people like Planck and Einstein and Bohr. And then in about 1925, it got developed into a fully-fledged theory by Heisenberg and Schrodinger. And almost all the key players were meeting in 1927 to discuss the quantum theory. And a lot of the mysterious features that we still argue about today were discussed at this meeting. It was recently, the proceedings were translated into English and they're available on the web, and it's fascinating to see that these guys were having discussions about the same topics that we still worry about today. So as I said, I'm going to start just by exposing you to some simple phenomena, stuff we see in the lab. So I'm going to use a Stern-Gerlach apparatus as my main example. So how does this work? Well, you have an oven over here. And it's putting out, let's say, silver atoms. So it has a little aperture, and you get a collimated beam of silver atoms. You press the button to open the aperture and let an atom out. And And then you pass it through this pair of magnets, which are shaped in such a way that in between there's an inhomogeneous magnetic field. And these atoms have magnetic dipole moments, and when they pass through such a field, it deflects them in proportion to the strength of their magnetic dipole moment along this axis that the magnet is aligned along. And so in a classical world, according to classical theories, what people expected was that this that an atom would be deflected at any angle, right, from zero, not deflected at all, to some maximum angle and some minimum angle, depending on the strength of that field. But the experiment shows that something different happens. Instead of being deflected at an arbitrary angle, these atoms are only ever deflected at one of two angles, so either up or down, which seems to indicate that their magnetic dipole moment takes not a continuum of possible values along that axis, but it's only ever plus h bar over 2 or minus h bar over 2 along that axis. So that's called quantization of angular momentum. And Sternberger like discovered this. It was very surprising. But I want to focus on the kinds of statistics. What sorts of probabilities do you see the up and the down outcome with? So if you do this and you make sure that only one atom is passing through the magnet at a given time, and then after it comes out of the magnet, you look at whether it went up or down, you find that half the time they come up and half the time they come down. And if you try to make your experiment better, you typically just get closer to precisely a half a half. And so now I'm going to imagine that you take these two beams and using magnets again, which I haven't indicated, you recombine them and you pass them out of an output port of this whole device. And so the idea is going to be this thing is going to prepare something which you know passed a test for up for this magnet, or passed a test for down. And then we're going to see what happens to it. So I don't want to redraw this every time, so I'm going to make a schematic. So that little box at the top with a Z on it just means that inside the box there is one of these magnets oriented along Z. And the two little squares are going to be LED lights, which just tell us whether we got the top outcome or the bottom outcome. And this, of course, is just represented by a box with a button on it. So the idea is that if I press the button on the oven box, then half the time I'll see the green light come on, half the time I'll see the red light come on. That's what we see. The second experiment is going to be precisely the same, except this whole magnet is going to be rotated so that the south pole is over here pointing up along the x-axis rather than the z-axis. And I'll indicate that by a box that has an x on it. And again, what we see is that if we press the button on the oven, then half the time we get x, half the time we get green, and half the time we get red. Okay, very simple. Now, here's something more interesting. As I said, you can pass that system out of the box, and you can put it into a new box. So what happens if we do a Z measurement and then another Z measurement? You get exactly the same outcome. So if you got green the first time, you'll definitely get green the second time. And if you got red, then you'll definitely get red the second time. And it's similar with the X boxes. The outcome that you got on the first is always repeated on the second. So the slogan is that consecutive identical measurements always yield the same outcome. So if you've done your measurements carefully, this is what you see in the lab. Okay, now here's something different. What if I measure first along Z? So I should say technically we call these Z spin measurements or X spin measurements, but I'm just going to call them Z and X measurements, or Z boxes and X boxes. So if we measure along Z and say we get the green outcome, then what happens if we put that system through an X box? It's going to be random. Exactly. So half the time you get green, half the time you get red. And if you get the red outcome, it's the same. Half the time you'll get green on the X measurement, half the time you'll get red. Okay, so the slogan here is that the outcome of an X measurement is completely uncorrelated with the outcome of an immediately preceding Z measurement. They seem to have nothing to do with one another. And the same thing happens if you first measure X and then you measure Z. The outcome of Z uncorrelated with the outcome of the preceding X measurement. Good. All right. Here's the first sort of interesting one that I think you might not be able to call so easily. So we have Z and then X and then Z. So we do the first Z measurement, we get some outcome. Let's say it's green. Now what happens at the X measurement? Right? Still 50-50. So suppose we do it and we get red. Okay, so now the question is going to be, what happens with that final Z measurement? And there's two competing intuitions as to what might happen. So suppose I removed the Z box entirely, and I just passed the system to X, and then to Z. What would happen? It would be 50-50, exactly. The other possibility is if I remove the X box, which is probably what you're thinking. If I remove the X box, then I have Z and Z, and we get green. Exactly. So the question is, which of those two things is going to happen? Is it going to be 50-50, or is it going to be always green? So who thinks it's going to be 50-50? And who thinks it's going to be always green? Okay, well, you go to the laboratory, you do the experiment, because that's the way you can settle these sorts of things. You can't know ahead of time. And what you find is that it's 50-50. So, yeah, give yourself a pat on the back. And the slogan is that if you have an intervening X measurement, then it randomizes the outcome of a Z measurement. So two consecutive Z measurements don't reproduce their outcomes if in between them you have an X measurement. And it's the same thing if I had X and then Z and then X. The intervening Z would randomize the outcome of the X measurement. So this is what we see. Now, let's start moving towards these applications. Suppose that I have one of these preparation procedures happening, and it's behind a big wall. And all I'm going to do is I'm going to pass the system out of the wall and give it to a guy over here. So the guy over here can't see what's really going on back here. And in this scenario, I'm going to imagine that the guy knows that this thing was prepared with a Z box, but he doesn't know whether the outcome was green or red. And he gets the system, and the question is there anything he can do to figure out whether it was green or red? Yes? Put it through a Z box. Good. So he puts it through a Z box. He gets some outcome, green. But now you know that if you repeat two Z measurements, you always get the same outcome. So he knows that it must have been green behind the wall. So he can figure, and if he gets red, he knows that it must have been red behind the wall. So the point is that there's something he can do to distinguish those two preparations. He can do a measurement that will allow him to tell whether it was Z green or Z red behind the wall. So just by probing that system, he can answer that question. And similarly, if he was promised that it was an X measurement behind the wall, then he could do an X measurement and figure out whether it was X green or X red. Okay, but now consider this case. Suppose that he doesn't know whether the outcome was green or red, and furthermore, he doesn't know whether it was prepared with a Z measurement or an X measurement. Then what can he do? Yes? Sorry? You're saying, what would he assign 50-50 statistics to? There's four possibilities now. He doesn't know whether it's Z green.
Mm-hmm. Now that I'm going to go Z, it's green. But if you have Z and then X, you have 50-50. You have Z red, and then Z on the other side, you have red. Then you have Z and X, 50-50. Like that.
So I think you're saying that he can't settle the question of which of these four it was. Which measurement he does. So let me ask a slightly different question. Suppose he just chose to do a Z measurement, and suppose he got the green outcome. What are the preparations that are consistent with that? What can he conclude? What are the possibilities for what he
can Z green or either X.
Right. Okay. I think I've heard all the answers. It could be Z green. It could be X red, or it could be X green. That is clearly consistent. If it was X green, then there's a probability a half of getting Z green, so that's consistent. And similarly, if it was X red, there's a probability a half of getting Z green, so that's also consistent. The only thing that's not consistent is if it had been Z and red ahead of time, he never could have gotten that outcome. But the point is that
by doing a Z measurement, he can't infer exactly what happened here. He can only infer that it was one of three possibilities. These guys. He knows a little bit more than that. He knows that with probability a half, it was this one, and with probability a quarter, it was this one, and quarter, it was this one. So he knows a little bit more, but ultimately he can't figure out which of the four it was. So there's maybe one other thing to say about this. Does anybody have any ideas for how he might get around this? So far all I've told you, if he measures just Z, he can't infer. If he measures just X, he can't infer. Can you think of any other thing he might do?
Is this only one particle going through?
It's only one particle. So that's a good point. If let me be explicit about that. If he'd been guaranteed, look, we have 1,000 systems back here, and we're going to prepare them all in the same way. So for example, X red or X green or Z red or Z green, but they're all going to be the same. Then, of course, he could do a bunch of Z measurements on half of them and X measurements on the other half. And if he found, for example, that all the Z measurements came out green and half of the X measurements came out red and half the X measurements came out green, they'd say, aha, they must all be Z green because that's the kind of statistics I would expect. But here, he's told, you've only got one system. That's it. And so when he does an X measurement, he doesn't get any statistics. He doesn't say, you know, half the time it's going to come out green. He just sees green. And he doesn't know whether, you know, if he had more copies, whether he'd keep getting green or whether he'd get something different. So it's very important that he's only got the one system. Any other ideas for how he might probe it? Yes?
So if you put another box afterwards, if you put another X afterwards?
Good. Well, this is the case we saw earlier, right? So you might think, you know, before you've gone to the lambda experiments, that yeah, we could just measure Z and then we measure X, and thereby we could know both what happened in an X box and what happened in a Z box. But the problem with that is that, as we saw earlier, if I measure X, Z, X, then the intervening Z measurement randomizes the X outcome. So that second X outcome actually tells you nothing about the first X outcome.
Yes? I have a question. How do you measure the spin of the electron in the box? When you do the measurement, you don't disturb the electron, right? You need to use a photon, no?
What you could do is you could the spin of the let's call it an atom, say it's a silver atom. The spin of the silver atom causes it to deflect in one of two directions.
Yeah.
And so now its position becomes correlated with its spin. And what you typically do is you measure its position, for example, by shining light and seeing if the light gets deflected or not. And then you use magnets to recombine it into one beam. So you've found out that it's definitely spin up.
When you use the photon, do you disturb the atom? And maybe he might be randomized and don't know the spin now. I don't know if you...
To some extent, the question of do measurements disturb systems is kind of what we're going to be probing in this talk. So we've seen one way in which that's true, in the sense that if I measure X, Z, X, then it's clear that the Z measurement has disturbed the X predictions, right? Had I not done it, I would have been able to predict X perfectly. But because I did it, I now longer have no predictability about it. So there's that kind of sense of disturbance. But there's, I think, a different sense that you're maybe alluding to, which is that, you know, we should think of this system as having some properties corresponding to Z spin and X spin, and those properties are being disturbed. And in the second half of the talk, I'll mention whether we can think about those sorts of things. Okay, so the bottom line of all this is that whatever we do on the other side, it's impossible to distinguish between these four possibilities with certainty. And I mean, I haven't really proven this to you, because in quantum mechanics there are more measurements you can do besides this X spin and Z spin measurement. You can rotate the Stern-Gerlach apparatuses any way you like, and there are other measurements besides. But you can take it on faith that none of those help you in this task, right? All of those other measurements have less predictability about these preparations. So only the Z measurement, for example, makes the outcome of a preceding Z measurement certain to you. Every other measurement will have some uncertainty as to what happened if Z was prepared here. So there's really no way around this. It's impossible to distinguish these four states. Okay, so let's do a little bit of mathematics on this. Let's calculate the probability that you can estimate which of these four preparations happened. So it's just the probability of guessing whether the measurement was Z or X, getting that right, times the probability of getting the red versus green question right, given that you got the Z versus X question right. And in the previous slide, I argued that, you know, you can't know anything about Z versus X, and that's true in general for all measurements. You learn nothing about Z versus X. So this probability is a half. But if you happen to guess correctly, say you guess Z and it really was Z, then you're going to get the same outcome. And therefore, you're going to guess red versus green correctly. So your probability will be 1 here. So your overall probability of guessing correctly is a half. And this is just another way of thinking about the impossibility of guessing which of these four occurred. If you could guess it perfectly, this would be 1. So the slogan is that there's no perfect information gain in quantum theory, you know, if I have these kinds of preparations. Okay, next scenario. Suppose behind the wall there's a preparation. In this case, it's Z red. It's passed out into the world. This guy's allowed to do some measurements on it. And then it gets passed back behind the wall, and it's subjected to another Z measurement. Okay, so suppose the guy measured Z. What's going to happen? He's going to get red, and we pass it behind the wall, and we're going to get red again, because no matter how many of these we do, it's always going to reproduce the outcome. So as far as the people behind the wall are concerned, it could be that the system, nothing happened to the system out there in the world. It just, you know, passed and came back and was passed through this box, because that would be consistent. But if the guy on the outside did an X measurement and got some outcome, say he got green, then what happens here? It's 50-50 again, because an intervening X measurement randomizes Z. So that means half the time, the people behind the wall will see a red outcome, and as far as they're concerned, maybe nothing happened to the system, because that's consistent with what they see. But half the time, they're going to get the green outcome. And in those cases, they know that something's happened to the system. Somebody out there in the world has tampered with it, because had they not, you would definitely see the red outcome here. So they have a way of detecting whether any measurements have been done on the system. Half the time, that's right. They can't know for sure whether measurements have been done on the system, but sometimes they get lucky and they find out that something's happened. All right, so let's do one other calculation here. What's the probability of passing the test behind the wall? Well, again, you have to calculate what's the probability of guessing correctly whether it's prepared and measured along Z, or whether it's prepared and measured along X, times, so you multiply that by the probability of passing the test, given that you guessed correctly, and then you have to add that to the probability that you guessed wrong, times the probability that you nonetheless passed the test, even though you guessed wrong. So the probability you guessed right is just the half, and the probability you guessed wrong is a half. If you guess right, you'll always pass the test, because you'll measure in the same basis, and it'll just reproduce the outcome. And if you guess wrong, well, you can get lucky half the time and still pass the test. Because if you do an X measurement, it could still come out Z red, and in that case, you've passed the test. So overall, your probability is 3/4 of passing the test. Okay. And the slogan here is that information gain causes a disturbance. This is the disturbance I was mentioning earlier, in the sense of a disturbance to your predictability about the outcomes of future measurements. So those are the ingredients I need, and now I can start telling you about how we can use quantum mechanics for various applications in cryptography. So let me start with quantum counterfeit proof money. All right, here's the idea. Well, how do we normally make money counterfeit proof? Or how do we, maybe not counterfeit proof, but how do we try to prevent counterfeiting? Yes. Make it difficult to duplicate. Exactly. But, of course, there's nothing in the laws of physics that prevent me from duplicating a $20 bill. If I wanted to, I could analyze that $20 bill extremely carefully, use all my technology at my disposal to figure out exactly what its state is, and then build another $20 bill that's in exactly that same state. So here, using quantum theory, we're going to come up with a different kind of scheme where basically if the laws of quantum physics are correct, then you can't reliably counterfeit the money. So it's a different kind of security. Usually we rely on the fact that the counterfeiter has limited resources, limited technology. We try to make it really hard for the counterfeiter. And it's usually a race between the counterfeiter and the mint, you know, who's got better technology. And every once in a while, you have to make it harder. And here, the idea is just to say, well, if the laws of physics are correct, then there's nothing the counterfeiter can do. So how does it work? Well, in the mint, they're going to build money that has some storage chambers in it. So these little circles are going to represent storage chambers for quantum systems. They could be, for example, the silver atoms we've been talking about so far. So for each silver atom, you prepare it. The mint prepares it by choosing a measurement at random, Z or X, and then recording what outcome is obtained. So for the first atom, the one that gets put into the first box, they write down in a logbook, it was measured along Z, the outcome was green. And for the second, it was measured along Z, the outcome was red, X red, and so on for all the atoms. And then in the logbook, they write down the serial number of that bill. Okay, and they store that information. And then they pass the bill out into circulation. Now, although we have the theory for this today, we don't have the technology yet. You might have noticed that there's no quantum money in circulation. And the reason is that the technical problem, is building these storage devices. What we want is to be able to keep a quantum system isolated from interactions with its environment for long periods of time. And that's what's very hard to do. So far, you know, the best we can do is using very large apparatuses and very short times. Yes? Hold on to that question. Let me just make one clarification. The serial number is going to be a number written down, and it's not going to be a quantum system. So the thing that you could worry about disturbing are going to be the states of those quantum systems. And we'll get to that. Yeah, we'll get to that. The serial number is going to be for the mint's purposes. So the mint will say, this is the bill in which atom 1 was prepared Z green and atom 2 was prepared Z red and so on. If they didn't have the serial number, they wouldn't know which bill we were talking about. So every bill is going to have a different kind of preparation, a random preparation. Well, let me explain how it's going to work. Okay, so this could happen if the Institute for Quantum Computing down the road comes up with some clever ways of storing quantum systems for longer, then you could see this in your lifetime. And it would probably look something like this. Okay. So here's the what you've all been asking. Here's the scheme. You've got these systems in the mint that are prepared along these, and the money's passed out into the world. And then what's going to happen is anybody who wants to verify the money, so let's say a merchant gets handed a bill. The merchant wants to verify that it's proper money. Thanks. They bring it back to the mint, and the mint looks at the serial number and then says, okay, well, we know how we prepared this bill, so let's measure every atom in the same basis. So they're going to take the atoms out of the storage chambers, measure them in the appropriate basis, and verify that they have the same outcome that it was prepared with. And if that's true, then it looks as if nobody's tampered with those atoms. But if, on the other hand, a counterfeiter out there in the world wants to make some copies of this money, then that counterfeiter is going to have to do some measurements. Because, if you don't do any measurements, then you just have probably 1/4 of guessing what the state of each atom is. It could be prepared in 1 of 4 ways, each of them. So the counterfeiter is going to want to do some measurements. And if the counterfeiter, because the counterfeiter doesn't know how these atoms were prepared, Z or X, the counterfeiter will have to guess. And sometimes the counterfeiter will guess correctly, sometimes incorrectly. So in this example, the counterfeiter guesses correctly for the third. It was prepared in X.
but for the others, guess is wrong. And so we can ask, what's the probability that the counterfeiter can make an arbitrary number of copies of this money? Well, to make an arbitrary number of copies that all pass the test at the bank, he would have to have guessed all those measurements right. If he guesses all the measurements right, then he gets all the colors right. When he brings it back to the bank, he has probability one of passing that test. So you can ask, well, what's the probability of guessing every one of those measurements correctly? It's just a half for each. In my example, I imagine there were 8 atoms in the money, so that's a half to the power 8. That's already a really low probability. So it's very unlikely that the counterfeiter can make a large number of copies. And if the bank is, or the mint is uncomfortable with that number, they want it to be even lower, all they have to do is increase the number of atoms. If you could put 100 atoms in there, you'd have a half to the power 100, and that is a very low probability. So that shows that using this kind of scheme, I haven't proved it to you in full generality because the counterfeiter does have other measurements available to them, not just the Z and the X. But even if you do the analysis with all the possibilities for the measurements, it's basically no different. The counterfeiter can't reliably make copies. Second question you can ask is, what if the counterfeiter takes the original bill back to the bank? So this is the question that came up earlier about the possibility of disturbance. So let's ask that question. What's the probability that the original passes the test, given that it's been measured by the counterfeiter? So we already asked for a single atom. You know, if I pass it from behind the wall, somebody does a measurement on it. They don't know which is the correct measurement to do, and they pass it back. 3/4 of the time they pass the test, because half the time they guess the basis right, and they always pass the test. And the other half of the time, they get lucky half of the time. So overall, it's 3/4. So the original, every atom only passes its test with probability 3/4. And if I take 3/4 to a high enough power, I also get a very low probability. So the answer is that if you're a counterfeiter and you start measuring the atoms, or if you're anybody, and you start measuring the atoms in your quantum money, then even that original is corrupted and won't pass the test at the bank. So in the future, when we have quantum money, whatever you do, don't measure it. Yes? Mm-hmm. Right.
So because of that, you won't be able to confirm that the original meets the score. So you could still confirm that you have to be a little error.
Good. So let me categorize this as a practical difficulty, that in order to verify that money's real, I need to go to the mint to some extent. You know, I can't just, look at the watermarks and say, oh, that looks real to me, or the hologram. I have to go to the mint. So first of all, even if that were true, there's ways around that, but even if that were true, it's still interesting that you can do this. It means that, a mint could always be sure that, something's coming back and nobody could have counterfeited it. So there's probably some interesting... You could, but there's a fancier way of doing it, which still maintains the security, and it uses something called quantum teleportation. So you're a merchant in your shop, and you get some quantum money. Now, you don't want to have to take it down the road to the mint and bring it to the mint and say, please test it, because that takes a long time. But what you can do is, if originally you share with the mint entanglement, so entangled pairs of particles, then what you can do in your shop is do some measurements on the money and your half of the entangled pairs, and then send some classical information down the phone lines to the mint, and you succeed in transferring the quantum states of your money into the mint. The mint can then do the test. They can send back on the phone, say, yeah, it's good money, and they can teleport back to you some new quantum states for your money so that this is still valid, and they'll update their records about what this serial number should correspond to, and then away you go. And so you can imagine that might happen quickly, and we could just use it. So I haven't told you the details of quantum teleportation, but that would be one solution to that problem. Other questions about quantum money? Yes?
So in effect, your money would then be more expensive than your credit card?
Oh, yeah. well, it would, of course, if I use these atoms, the spin of the atoms, then definitely, unless I had some, you know, very sophisticated shielding technology. But you can imagine that maybe the degrees of freedom that are being used aren't magnetic. So sort of every possible degree of freedom we know of is a quantum degree of freedom. So I could use the position of things. I could use the polarization of a photon. There's all kinds of stuff I could use. And so conceivably, it wouldn't be magnetic at all. Other questions? All right, let's move on to the next application, which is the quantum detection of eavesdroppers. All right, so here's one of the basic... One of the very basic problems in cryptography is how two people can communicate in private. So the problem usually is that if Alice and Bob are communicating down some telephone line, then an eavesdropper, who we always call Eve, can come in, put a wiretap on the line, and hear everything they're saying. So it's not very secure. So there's ways around this. Here's a really simple one. It's called the Caesar cipher. So suppose Alice wants to communicate to Bob the following message. Meet me at the river. Now, they can use the following scheme. Ahead of time, they agree on a key, which is a number between 0 and 25. And this number tells you how much Alice should shift the letters through the alphabet. So she takes every letter in her message, and she shifts it forward by 2, in this case. The key is 2. So M becomes O, E becomes G, Z becomes B, and so on. And she sends the ciphertext, the shifted version, to Bob. Bob, who knows the key, gets his text. He shifts every letter back by 2, and he recovers the original message. But to somebody who intercepts the message, it looks meaningless. So the question is, how can you break this code? Yes? Good. So you just have to do 25 or 26 shifts of all the letters, just look at what comes out and say, was there only one of them that's meaningful, or maybe there's a couple that are meaningful, and you could probably guess which is the intended message that way. There are more sophisticated schemes, but let me ask, is there another way you could imagine breaking this? It's a scheme that works for even more clever systems. Yes? Exactly. So it turns out that if you have enough English text, the frequency with which different letters in the English language appear is very precise. So E is the most frequent letter, and so on. And so you can start making educated guesses about what a given letter represents based on its frequency in the text. And then you can start plugging in, trying out letters and seeing, does this start looking like meaningful text? And it's, sort of like doing a crossword puzzle. After a while you might say, okay, well, that E was wrong, maybe it's this other letter, and you can figure it out. So these kinds of schemes can be broken. But fortunately, there's a scheme that cannot be broken. Here's how it works. It's called the Vernon cipher. The idea is that you have a much bigger key. Your key consists of numbers, a collection of numbers between 0 and 25, one for every letter of the message. So if you have a 16-letter message, then you need 16 numbers in your key. And each number is going to tell you how much to shift that letter by. So in this case, the first letter gets shifted by 7, second letter gets shifted by 20, the third by 4, and so on. And then Alice does that. She encodes the ciphertext, passes over to Bob. Bob can decode it by just shifting all the letters back. Okay, so now let's imagine an eavesdropper intercepts this message. Okay. Now, the first thing is, if the message is very long, the eavesdropper is going to have to take a long time to do all these possible decodings. There's not just 25 decodings now. There's 25 to the power of n, where n is the number of letters. So that's a much larger number of manipulations they have to do. But suppose they do it. Suppose the eavesdropper says, okay, I'm going to consider all the possible decodings of this ciphertext. The scheme that Alice and Bob use takes each of these numbers at random. Okay, so all the possible sequences are equally likely. So from the eavesdropper's perspective, any one of those decodings is equally likely. And the problem is that when you look at that set of 25 to the n decodings, you get every message of length n that exists. So every possible meaningful code of 16 letters is there as a possible decoding of the ciphertext. And so you're in no better situation than if you just guessed what the 16-letter message was. You have as much information as if you just guessed, because every sequence is possible. And that's called information theoretic security. Okay? Can't be broken. So so that's nice. There's only one trick here, which is that it uses up a lot of key. You know, for every letter you send, you need another piece of key. So that's a lot of data. And if Alice is, you know, the spy back at headquarters and Bob is the spy out in the field and they're communicating to one another a lot, then eventually Bob runs out of key. And then they have to replenish the key. And so that means that, you know, Alice will have to send out her most trusted agent with a briefcase handcuffed to her wrist to deliver to Bob the new key. And, you know, along the way that could get intercepted and so on. So the question becomes, how can you get key out into the field? How can you distribute key in a secure way? And that's the problem that quantum mechanics can help us with, the problem of distributing that key. So it's not a question of preventing people from reading the message. We're going to use the Vernon cipher to make the message private. We're going to use quantum mechanics to generate a key. Okay? So the way we do it is that in addition to this classical channel, we give Alice and Bob a quantum channel, something along which quantum systems can be transferred while making sure that they don't interact with the environment. So that's like the quantum storage device in the quantum money. It's something that you know, technology has to improve so that we can have more better quantum communication schemes. But we actually are doing pretty well here because we can use photons, and actually photons don't interact much when you pass them through air, and actually, you know, so we can transfer quantum information pretty reliably even today. So here's how the scheme works. So Alice is going to prepare each one of her quantum systems. It doesn't have to be a photon. It could be any system you like. So, you know, we could imagine that these are still the atoms. She prepares each one of them in a random basis, Z or X. She chooses these at random, and she records the outcome she gets for each one. Writes that down, passes them over to Bob. Bob also chooses a measurement to do on each one at random. He doesn't know what Alice has measured, so he just chooses at random. And some of the time, he happens to get it right, and some of the time, he gets it wrong. He registers the outcomes. And then what they do is they communicate openly on a public channel what measurements they chose, not what outcome they got. What outcome they got is what's eventually going to make up the key, but what measurement they chose. And so they'll be able to go and find those cases where Bob chose a different measurement from Alice, and they're just going to throw away that data. It's not going to appear in the rest of the protocol. So in this case, the second system was useless to them, and the fifth system was also useless to them because they chose different measurements. But the other three, they happen to measure the same thing, and they're going to keep those. All right. And now the idea is that when they measure the same thing, then the outcome they got, green or red, is going to be random, but it's going to be the same for both of them. And so it's the thing that's ultimately going to make up the key. It's going to be a sequence of zeros and ones. So say green is zero and red is one. So they'll get this long string of zeros and ones that they share in common. And then if they use you know, five of those bits together, they can get a number between 0 and 25, and they can encode their messages that way. What they really want to know is whether there was an eavesdropper. Okay, they don't want to just trust that this worked out well. So what they're going to do is they're going to take a small subset of all those systems that they did this on. So they've done this on lots of systems. They take a small subset, and they choose that subset at random. So the eavesdropper does not know which subset they're using. They have to share a little bit of key ahead of time to do that, because they have to agree on which ones they're going to use. That's okay. So they choose this subset at random, and then they announce for that subset what outcomes they got. So they've chosen some at random. Maybe the first system is in that random set. And then Alice says, well, I got green. And Bob says, I also got green. Well, that's good, because that's consistent with nobody having tampered with the system. But if, for example, you know, the fourth one were in that subset. Then when Alice announced that she got green, Bob would announce, oh, I got red. That means that something happened to that system between you and me. And potentially what it means is that there's an eavesdropper who's trying to measure these systems, and that's why we're getting the different outcomes. So if you take the random subset and you find too many of your outcomes are different, you know, okay, well, it looks as if somebody has tampered with it, or at least we can't be sure that somebody hasn't tampered with it, so we're not going to use any of these. We're just not going to communicate. We have not established a secure key. But if you look at that random subset and there's very little noise, then you can be confident that the eavesdropper, you know, has not been tampering and that the rest of the bits are secure. And then you can use those in a Vernon cipher. So, you know, here's the idea. If the eavesdropper, who doesn't know what these measurements are, because those haven't been announced, comes along and just chooses a measurement at random, then, of course, sometimes she can avoid detection because she chooses right. But some of the time, like here, you know, she measures Z, Alice prepared a long X, and that's why Bob gets this different outcome here. And they discover her tampering. So that's how it works. Are there questions about quantum key distribution? Yes? I don't think you'd have to share a quarter. The question is, you know, how much do I have to sacrifice to give a good test? That's a good question. So there's something called privacy amplification, which means that even if you do detect some noise on the channel, so you have some errors, you can take the rest of it and you can hash it. So you combine that data in various ways, and you get less data from it, but that data is more secure. So I'm not sure exactly the details of how that works. So I guess it depends on how much privacy you're looking for. So the more privacy you want, probably the more you're going to have to sacrifice. Okay, thanks. Other questions? Yes?
Access to the code so they can move on to that kind of stuff?
If two private citizens decided to use this scheme, what would, you know, the spooks have to do to break it? So there's some security assumptions that are made here. So for example, I imagine that the inside of Alice's laboratory is secure. So in her laboratory, she has it written down, you know, which measurements she's performed and which outcomes she's obtained. And clearly, if that were not secure, you know, if somebody had access to that, then they could get the secret key. It would just be the greens and the reds that she's recorded. Or if they knew exactly what measurements she did, then they could measure the systems as they're passing to Alice and Bob and get the key. But if you assume that your adversary doesn't have access to the inside of your lab and can only probe these systems as they go by, then yes, you have security. It doesn't matter how much technological power your adversary has. As long as the laws of quantum physics are correct, they say that the adversary will have limited information about the key you're setting up. So it's a very strong form of security. The security we use today in cryptography is not of that sort. It's typically of the sort that says, in order to decipher this, you need to have a lot of computational power. Like, you need to be able to, for instance, factor large numbers quickly. And nobody in the world, as far as we know, knows how to do that. Quantum computers are able to do that, but we don't have quantum computers yet. In any case, you're relying on the fact that, you know, your adversary is not clever enough to solve this hard computational problem. But you have no guarantee from physics that that's the case. So here you really have a guarantee from the laws of physics. Let me make one other note about that. There's some new schemes that have come out just in the last few years that are even more secure in the sense that they say, look, the laws of quantum physics could be wrong, but still the scheme will be secure. What the scheme relies on is, one, that you can't signal faster than the speed of light, and two, certain predictions of quantum mechanics, called Bell inequality violations, and we'll come to that, still hold in the world. So it's a much, it's an even stronger scheme. You know, quantum mechanics could be replaced by another theory, and those schemes would still be secure. Yes? Yes. So this, yep. Exactly. This scheme does not protect you from, that's called jamming. You know, so they can jam your signal and make sure that Alice can't communicate with Bob at all. And you know that, you know, one easy way to do that is, you know, just clip the wire if you but in a sense that's not what people are so worried about in cryptography, because if your signal's jammed, then at least the adversary is not getting information. What you really want to protect yourself against is thinking that you've got a secure channel, thinking that you're communicating in private, but in reality, the eavesdropper knows what you're saying. So that's the goal of cryptography. Good. Yes? Well, why don't you hold off on that question until the end, because we're going to talk about entanglement in a few minutes, and it'll be easier to answer then. Yes? You mean in the cases where Bob and Alice have chosen to implement different measurements? That's right. In those cases, they can't use those systems as part of their key. So there's a certain fraction. So the thing is that what you get out of this protocol is this long sequence of zeros and ones, which will make up ultimately, if I go back, will make up this key. And so if you're trying to generate these things, and on the second system, you know, you fail to generate it, well, that's okay. You just throw it out, and you generate some more bits. And then that, you know, the next five bits you make, that'll give you your next number. And then the next five bits you succeed at making will give you your next number, and so on. So it doesn't matter that some of those bits don't work out. You just keep going. And then when you're done, you code your whole message. OK, well, let me move on, because we're running out of time. So I want to have a brief chat about hidden variable models. So now we're on to the part of the talk about what does it all mean, not what's it useful for, but how do we interpret this phenomenology that I've described thus far. So one idea for interpreting it is called hidden variable models. And I think it's a very beautiful idea. So I want to tell you a little bit about how it works for these particular experimental scenarios I've described thus far. So I think, you know, one of the best analogies for explaining the spirit of a hidden variable model is Plato's allegory of the cave. So I don't know if any of you have come across this, but in a Platonic dialogue called The Republic, there's a dialogue between Socrates and a guy called Glaucon. And Socrates describes the following scenario. He says, imagine, if you will, some people who are prisoners in a cave, and they've been there their entire lives. They've never known anything else. And they're forced to sit in this cave and look dead ahead at a wall in front of them. And what happens on the wall is that people behind them cast shadows of various objects onto the wall. So there's a light behind them, and they pass various objects which cast shadows. And Socrates says, you know, don't you think that these people in the cave will come to think that those shadows are reality? It's all they've ever known. Clearly, they'll think the shadows is it. That's the reality. And then he says, we're like the people, the prisoners in the cave. So we look around us. We think we see the reality. But in fact, we're just seeing an aspect of reality. Much as here, these prisoners only ever see two-dimensional aspects of three-dimensional objects. Okay. So the idea of a hidden variable model is very similar. It says that there's some deeper reality, which the quantum state does not represent. But when we do our measurements, we're getting different we're just finding out about different aspects of that deeper reality. So I'm going to tell you about a toy theory. It's a toy theory because it doesn't reproduce all the predictions of quantum mechanics, but it does reproduce all the predictions I've talked about today. Okay, so it manages to capture some part of quantum mechanics. And it certainly gives you the flavor for how a hidden variable model works. So these systems we've been talking about are now going to be assumed to have properties. So when we do a Z measurement, for example, the assumption is going to be that there's some property of the system that determines whether the outcome is Z red or Z green. And there's another property of the system that's going to determine whether the result of an X measurement is green or red. So I'm just going to draw these properties, you know, so X can take values 0 or 1, that's green and red, and Z can take values 0 and 1. And so there's four possible pairs of values for those two guys, which means that, you know, for each of these different states of the system, you can tell exactly what would happen if you did a Z measurement and what would happen if you did an X measurement. But now the theory postulates that for some reason, every observer in the world is limited in how much they can know about the physical state of the system. So for instance, it's allowed that you know what X is, you know what the value of X is. But in that case, you don't know anything about the value of Z. So for instance, you can know that X is 0, but Z is equally likely to be 0 or 1, so probability half for each. And I'll just represent that by coloring this in blue. It's a uniform distribution over these two options. Or you could know that X was 1, and then you'd know nothing about Z. Alternatively, you're allowed to know what Z is, but then you don't know what X is. So you have these two kinds of distributions. Or it's also possible that you know what the sum of X and Z is, modulo 2. So either X and Z are the same, or they're different. And those would correspond to these kinds of states of knowledge. And then, of course, you could know nothing at all, which would just be a uniform distribution over all four. So these aren't really going to be of use to us. They're just to tell you a bit more about the theory. But the idea is that the world is such that you're always limited in what you can know. And this is a lot like Plato's cave, right? Because if you think of that dot in the four, think of it as a ball in four chambers, in a box with four chambers. If I shine light on one side, then I'll only be able to sort of see a shadow of whether it's x0 or x1. And if I shine light from the bottom, I'll see a shadow which tells me whether it's z0 or z1. But if I can't shine light from both sides, or I can't look on the top of the box, then I can never do both those measurements at once. So this theory is basically postulating something like that. Here are two different kinds of shadows for the underlying system. Okay, so if you take seriously the idea that there's a limit to how much you can know, then clearly you wouldn't be able to measure precisely which of the four states it is. All you'd be able to measure would be things like X, which would just tell you whether it's 0 or 1. And I'll just color that green and red. Or you can measure Z, or you can measure their sum. So what happens to these experiments we talked about? Well, if you assume that the oven is a preparation where you don't know what the state is at all, equivalently, you can think of it as follows. As you generate systems from this oven, you get a whole collection of systems. A quarter of them are systems that have X is equal to 0, Z is equal to 0, and a quarter of them are systems that have X is equal to 0, Z is equal to 1, and a quarter for the other two possibilities. And so when you do a measurement on that guy, and you ask, well, is it going to be on the left or the right? Well, half of them have states on the left, half of them have states on the right, but you don't know what kind of system you've got. And so all you see is that half the time it comes out green and half the time it comes out red. And if you measure X, again, you don't know whether your system is on the top or on the bottom, but you know that half of them are on the top, half of them are on the bottom, so you predict that it's going to be this sort of pattern. Then if you ask, well, what's the distribution after the measurement's over? Let's say I got the green outcome. What kinds of properties do the systems have coming out the other side of the box? Well, we know that if I did another X measurement, I'm going to get the same outcome, the green outcome. And so the possible probability distributions that are consistent with that is just this one. This is the only state of knowledge that's consistent with getting that green outcome all the time. So it must be that after I do this X measurement, I leave it with half of the systems having this property and half the systems having that property. And then I can explain this phenomenology. And that kind of makes sense, because if you've seen the green outcome, then you know that whichever, you know, that particle that you got wasn't in one of these two guys. So you assign 0 to them. And you say, well, it must have been one of these two. Similarly, if you measure Z, then because your outcomes will repeat, you can conclude that this must be the probability distribution after a Z measurement is made. And of course, in this case, if I measure Z, get green, I prepare this distribution. If I measure X now, well, half the time it's going to be on the top and half the time it's going to be on the bottom. So I'm going to get my half-half statistics, as we saw. The only final question is, what happens after this measurement here of x in order to enforce the randomization of z? So this is the one tricky bit of this theory. You know that if you get x red here, then you have to prepare this distribution. That's the only valid distribution that will then make further z x measurements come out red. But that means that this x measurement has to disturb the state of the system in this hidden variable model. It can't leave it undisturbed. Why? Well, here's what would happen if there was no physical disturbance, right? You measure z, which is left versus right. You find that whatever the system's properties were, it was somewhere on the left. Now, if all you did here was find out whether it's on the bottom or on the top, but not disturb it, then you could rule out this guy here, right? Because you already knew he wasn't here. And your measurement didn't disturb the state at all. So if you find out it's on the top, you must conclude it's got to be in this corner, because it was here before, and I found out that it's on the top. So it's in the corner. But we know that that's not the state you get, according to this principle that you have limited knowledge. So you can ask, well, what would happen if there was a disturbance? For example, what would be the final probability distribution if, when I measure x, some of the time it flips the value of z? So remember, this is z. So it would flip it from z is equal to 0 to z is equal to 1. That would be your distribution at the end. And so in order to get the original distribution, this one here, it has to be that half the time there's no disturbance, and half the time the disturbance flips the value of z. If this is what happens during an x measurement, then everything works out. So you just add that to your theory. You say this is the way the theory must be in order to explain all these predictions. So in a hidden variable model, this disturbance to your predictability is a result of a physical disturbance half the time to the state of the system, which is kind of intuitively what you would think. And maybe it's intuitively, you know, it's sort of what you hear about Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You know, if you measure x, then you end up disturbing the momentum. So in a hidden variable model, you can take that seriously, that there's two properties, position and momentum. They're like the x and the z properties. If you measure one, you sometimes disturb the other. So that's all very nice. However, I'm just saying this here. However, these kinds of models cannot do justice to the full theory of quantum mechanics, unfortunately. So they're very pretty, but there's predictions of quantum mechanics that you can't easily explain within these kinds of models. So in the last bit, that's what we're going to talk about, the problems with these kinds of models. And that's Bell's theorem. So this is an account of why any realistic account of quantum mechanics, any account in terms of systems having properties that are then revealed by measurements, so that includes these hidden variable models, have to be not local or non-local in some sense. Okay, so to tell you about Bell's theorem, I need to introduce a new kind of box which is going to prepare entangled particles. So you might have heard about this at the IQC. You can take a photon, put it through a certain kind of nonlinear crystal, and then you get two photons coming out at half the frequency of the original photon. And the first one comes out somewhere on this cone, and the second one comes out somewhere on this cone. And you take those cases where one of them comes out here and the other one comes out here on the two intersection points. And then you feed one of those photons out one output port and the other one out the other output port. So again, I'm not going to tell you the mathematical formalism of quantum mechanics and how you represent these things. What I will tell you is what happens if you do measurements on these pairs of particles. I'm going to represent this whole box with just a box that has two output ports and an E. And I just imagine that one of those particles goes off to the left and one goes off to the right, and then they get subjected to measurements. I'm not going to do X and Z measurements now. It turns out I need a different pair of measurements. But you don't really need to know what they are. I'm just going to call them S and T. So they're just two different measurements. So some of the times you might do S on both. Some of the time you might do S on one, T on the other, or vice versa, T on the left, S on the right, or T on both. And those are the only experiments we're going to consider. And now I'm going to tell you about certain kinds of correlations you get between the outcomes of these measurements. And what you would expect is that you could explain those correlations in the way we explain most correlations, that there's some properties of these systems that determine what the outcome is going to be. And the reason the outcomes are correlated is because the properties of those two systems are correlated. You know, that would be a natural explanation. And that's the explanation that's not going to work for Bell correlations. All right, so to explain this, I'm going to need some volunteers. So do I have two volunteers who want to face a challenge? Okay, I saw these two guys first. So why don't you come up here? And I'm also going to need Richard and Michael to help me. Okay, so to reward your bravery in volunteering, you each have an opportunity to win a dollar. You don't have an opportunity to win a dollar. You just have the, you know, benefit of being here. Okay, so if you just wait a moment, I'll explain how the game works, but I need to distribute to the referees a card, a pen, and a loony. There you go. This is for you. Okay. So, so maybe if you just position yourself somewhere where you can see the screen, doesn't matter where you are in the room for now. So you guys are going to be simulating the particles. Okay. So it's going to be your job to answer questions that the measurement devices are going to pose to you. Richard and Michael are the measurement devices. Okay. So each of them is going to either measure S or T, and they're going to choose whether to measure S or T by flipping the loony I've given them. And if it comes out heads, it's S, and if it comes out T, tails, then they ask T. And they're going to ask their question by just writing S or T on the piece of paper. And you guys are going to answer the question by just writing red or green on the piece of paper. Okay? Now, okay, so that's all you have to do is just answer that one simple question. And you're going to have to produce certain kinds of correlations, which I'm going to tell you about. But you're allowed to prepare ahead of time. You're allowed to collaborate and come up with a scheme so you can correlate your strategies. So are you ready to see the challenge? Here it is. Okay, so can you make sure you can see the screen? So as I said, there are two possible measurements, S and T, with two outcomes each. And which of S or T occurs at each wing of the experiment is going to be chosen at random. And now here's what you have to do. Whenever it happens that the same measurement is made on both sides, then your outcomes have to agree. So if it's S and S or T and T, then you're allowed to answer green or red, but you better be answering with the same color. That's how you win. And if you get different measurements made on the two sides, then your outcomes had better disagree. Okay, so you need to come up with a plan that says something like, okay, if you get S, answer this. If I get S, I'll answer that, and so on, for all the possibilities of what might occur so that you win the game. So I'm going to give you a few minutes to think about a strategy. Meanwhile, everybody, you should get together in small groups and try to come up with a strategy that wins. So just take a minute or so to think about it. These are the only things you need to win. You have to satisfy. If you violate one of these rules, you lose. Are you ready? Okay, all right, so we're ready. So the scenario now is that one of you is going to go after this wing, one of you is going to go after this wing, and when I say go, they're going to flip their coins, they're going to make the measurements, and we're going to be watching you to make sure there's no funny business communicating to one another what you've got. So, okay, go ahead. And now we flip the coins. And now you guys should conceal what you're writing. Write down the question on the piece of paper. Don't say out loud what your measurement is. You guys don't communicate to one another. Just write on your piece of paper whether it's S or T. And then the contestant has to answer by writing on the paper red or green. Okay. And now if you've got the outcomes, I'll collect them. Okay. Thank you. And now we see whether they win the prize. Okay, so over here, if I just can find some chalk. On the left, the question turned out to be T, and the answer was red. And on the right, the question ended up being S, and the answer was green. And so they win. So you now get the loony. Oh, it's gone. Oh, well. But we're going to have, so you can sit down now. Thank you very much. And Michael, I'm going to need you for one other version of this game. So here's your second loony. And I need to give you another piece of paper. Here we go. Okay, I need two more volunteers for the next version. This is easy money. So one here and back there. Yeah. Okay, so make sure you can see the screen. Okay. Here's, oh, I forgot to do something. I wanted to ask the previous two contestants, what was your strategy? How did you win?
Okay, whenever it was S, you whenever it was T, you
good. So that's what I've indicated here. So if you get S, answer green. If you get T, answer red. Now, the four possibilities are those four lines. So if you see the horizontal lines where you both get asked S or both get asked T, your answers agree. And the diagonal lines where you get asked different questions, your answers disagree. So it wins 100% of the time. Okay, so next strategy. Next challenge. So the rules of the game are the same. You're each going to be asked one of these two questions at random. You're going to have to answer green or red. And now, whenever the same measurement is made, then your answers have to disagree. And different measurements, your answers have to agree. So take a couple of minutes to think about how to win the game. You ready? Okay, go to your stations. And go. Have you got the answer now? Oh, it's coming. Thank you. And here, great. Okay, so in this case, actually, the coin flips came out the same. T on the left, S on the right. We got an answer green on the left and green on the right. And you win, because if the measurements were different, then your outcome should agree. So let's give them a round of applause. Thank you. Collect your money. So, Richard, Mike, you can sit down. Thank you for your help. Yeah? Great. So there's one more chance to win money. This is the bell challenge, okay? So this is the real deal. These were just warm-ups. Okay, we're not going to act this one out. So any of you can have an opportunity to win the next prize. Okay, so this is sort of goes without saying. How do we win the last game? Well, it's sort of like the previous case, except now the two players have to use the opposite strategy. So if one player is going to answer green for S and red for T, the other player answers red for S and green for T. And in that way, whenever they're asked the same, their answers disagree. Whenever they're asked different questions, their answers agree. Yes? Sorry? Say it again? No, because sometimes their answers have to agree, right? Like here. If one person on one side always answered red and the person on the other side always answered green, then they would always disagree. But they need to agree sometimes. So this is the strategy that can win that game. Okay, so now we move on to the final challenge. Okay, so it's exactly the same. On both sides, there'll be one of two measurements, S or T, with two possible outcomes, green or red. And now, whenever the T measurement is made on both sides, the outcomes have to disagree. In all the other scenarios, S and S, S and T, or T and S, the outcomes have to agree. So I want you to again, get into small groups, take a few minutes, and try to figure out how to win this game. Question? So does anybody have an answer? Okay. Shauna? So on the left? Okay. Both S's are green. One person's T is red, and the other person's T is green. Okay. So let's test. If they both get asked T, then their answers have to disagree. And that's true. Their answers disagree. If they both get asked S, their answers agree. That works. If one gets asked S, the other gets asked T, their answers agree. But then you have a problem.
No, TS doesn't work.
TS does not work, right? This is supposed to agree, but it doesn't. So I haven't done it. You were there first, so I'll get you. Okay. Okay. Yes? S2 is equal to T1? Okay. Good. Which violates one. Okay, yes, that's the answer. It can't be done. So you win the final the final $2 all to yourself. There you go. This is always the most expensive lecture for me to give. So let me ask one other question. No prize for this, but what's the highest probability of winning this game? 75%, right, because no matter what you choose, so for example, you don't need to set these all equal. You could, for example, have this scheme here, and you still get 3 out of the 4 connections right. But there's no scheme that'll get more than 3 out of the 4 connections right. So if you, and remember, these things are chosen at random, so 3/4 of the time, you'll get an answer that, a question that you can answer and win, and 1/4 of the time, you'll get unlucky, and you'll lose. So if we do these experiments in the lab, and if those particles have some properties that determine what the outcomes are going to be, like our contestants had a strategy, a plan for how to answer, then at most they're going to be able to win this game, generate these correlations, 3/4 of the time. Okay, so that's what I said, 3/4. And the amazing thing is you go to the lab, you do this, and you find that the quantum systems win 85% of the time.
What?
that's exactly the reaction you should have. This is one of the central mysteries of quantum mechanics. They win 85% of the time. So the question is, how do they do it? So let's say that they're cheating. How could you cheat and win this game all the time? So let's think, suppose we'd acted it out here. How could the contestants cheat and win all the time? Send what kind of signal? Wink. But what would the wink be representing besides, hey buddy? Exactly. That if one contestant managed to communicate to the other, okay, I've just been asked T, then that helps the other person answer their question. So that, for example, here, if the person on the left could say whether they're measuring S or T, whether they've been asked that question, then the person on the right could choose to answer the T question in different ways depending on what the person on the left got asked. So they answer red if they got asked T, and they answer green if they got asked S, and then they always win. Okay, so you could imagine that. That could have happened today. But now we can improve the experiment. Here's what we can do. We can move these two sides of the experiment very far away from one another and make it so that the outcome has to occur in a short time after the measurement is chosen, after the coin is flipped. Similarly over here, at around the same time, and you choose it in such a way that light, even a signal propagating at the speed of light, will not have time to make it over here before the outcome is registered. So even if you send a signal about whether it's S or T, it doesn't get here in time. Okay? So suppose you do the experiment like that. You really separate the two halves, and you'd make these things occur very quickly. You'd expect that it would be 75%. But lo and behold, it's still 85%. The experiment distinguishes quantum theory from the predictions of any local theory, and you find that quantum theory is corroborated. So now it's very mysterious, because the one avenue for cheating seems to be blocked. So when you're trying to explain, give me a sec, Bell's theorem, there seems to be a tension. Okay? I would say that the mystery of Bell's theorem is a tension. On the one hand, and I haven't explained this in detail, but in quantum mechanics, you're not allowed to send signals faster than speed of light. So that little set of correlations can't be used to actually send information. So what that means is that at one wing, the probabilities of different outcomes are independent of what was measured on the other wing. Okay? But the particular outcome at one wing has to depend on what was measured on the other wing, which means that there must be superluminal causes. So maybe these hidden variables, which we can't know everything about, they are superluminally communicating with one another. But we, at the macroscopic level, who have limited information about them, can't use those causes for our purposes to send signals. So this is not an outright contradiction, but it's a real tension. Because if it's true that there are these superluminal causes, then why on earth can't we use them? Why should the universe be so conspiratorial as to prevent us from using these things? So this is a tension between, on the one hand, the theory of relativity, and on the other hand, the theory of quantum mechanics. I think it's nobody has done a good job of relieving this tension thus far. So it's a big open problem, and so I invite you to think about it. Hopefully, one of you might solve the problem. Anyways, that's all for today. Thanks for your attention.